Welcome to the Body Meets Mind podcast, philosophies and strategies for an elevated life. I'm Tom.
And I'm Paulie. We interview world authorities and experts in health and wellness optimization, psychology and spirituality.
And we don't mind chewing the fat either, just the two of us.
If you feel like being part of a casual yarn about self-awareness and growth, pull up a chair because the coffee's still hot.
We'll see you on the inside.
Hello and welcome to the Body Meets Mind podcast, a philosophies and strategies for an elevated life. My name is Paulie and this is Tom. How are you, buddy?
Mate, very good. I think today we'll probably be really honing in on the philosophies for an elevated life. Maybe some strategies, but we're getting to the deeper roots today, I think.
Very cool, which leads us to our incredibly wonderful guest, Menachem Wolf. I want to thank you so much for jumping on the show and having a bit of a yarn to us.
My pleasure. Really happy to be here. Yarning.
Menachem, tell us a little bit. Firstly, I want to just lay a little bit of a background as to mine and your relationship. We've known each other for some time. In fact, you married myself and my wife. Is that true or is that not true, Menachem?
That is very true. And as my kids like to laugh, I've married many people in my life. And I feel that way. I feel that there is an intimate bond that's built when you get involved in someone's wedding. But yes. Mm. I confess. This is true.
You confess. It's still really like some of the conversations that we had pre and post wedding still resonate and remain kind of as anchors in mine and Nat's kind of conversation and relationship. Good. Which is really great because the reference point that we've had still remains really, really kind of vibrant in mine and Nat's relationship.
Excellent. That's all I can ask for.
Yes, exactly right. And, so you've been present in my life. I'm obviously Jewish and, you know, you've had that kind of link and aspect for me personally. But, Tom, I'd love for you to kind of offer a kind of perspective as to how you're coming into this conversation as well.
Yeah. Well, Menachem, thank you so much for joining us on the show. First thing, mate, I suppose my perspective, I've always been very interested in religion, meaning existentialism. I was raised a Catholic. My uncle is a brother. A lot of my family's from Adelaide, but religion, spirituality has been in my life since the dawn. The context for me, mate, is that I developed a real fear around eternal hell, this idea of what I thought was eternal hell as a young kid. You don't really go into the more psychological components of that until you start inquiring and living a more reflective life. So I became really nervous about that. And then as a result, I did a 180 and fell in love with atheism, which was a very clear avoidance strategy. So I fell in love with Dawkins. I was almost flying a flag, you know, loving all this stuff. You
became religious.
Well,
that's you became exactly, a religious atheist.
I really did. I really did. That's exactly right. And I think in becoming more interested in some of the philosophies of religion, and trying to cultivate my own spirituality, which honestly just began as a way to learn more about who I am and my place in the world, I started to really fall in love with some of these ideas that were inherent not only in Catholicism but also in Judaism and Buddhism and Hinduism and these ideas around morality and pro-social behavior that have been around for thousands of years. So I think for me, hearing from you and what you've learned, with being so versed in just one of those particular religions is going to be just really, really beneficial. And I'm so excited by it. And I actually have a question as a to run off that. I remember reading a study a couple of years ago about this dichotomy of religion and spirituality. It seems that a lot of people in the West, especially in the younger generations, are becoming less religious but more spiritual. And as someone who has, mm-hmm. got a couple of anchors in both of these fields with Spirit Grow as well that we're Paulie and I are excited to talk about. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on that and what and why you think that might be the case and what people are getting from spirituality that perhaps they're not finding in religion, and if we can bring those two together. And yeah.
Okay. It's actually it's a very, very good question. Not that you need me to tell you that it's a good question, but I say that it's a question that many people are asking, and some are asking because of market research. They need to know why so that they can alter and tailor their product. And to others like yourself and myself, this is an intriguing concept, because for most of the past couple thousand years, religion has been the backbone of everything. And however we want to define the West, it has been religious more so than spiritual, at least how we may think of it. That's not to say there wasn't a spirituality within the West, but all right, we'll come back to that. But so to your question, it's an intriguing one. I'm not a social scientist. I'm not a anthropologist, so I'm going to put forward an idea, but it's my idea, or it's informed from other ideas, but it's not an educated idea by certain standards. But this is what I see, and this is what I think, and also somewhat what I experience. So that is, religion has become very dogmatic and very authoritarian. And it has become very process oriented, and it has, but the communication of the religion and the practice of the religion has lost its spirituality. So what is it trying to achieve? So if we could just jump over to America, because I think America is an excellent metaphor for religion, where you've got many, many people who believe in the religion of the Constitution. But are they really delving into the deeper meaning of the Constitution? So there's this whole religion around guns and the right to own a gun, bear a gun, carry a gun, whatever it is, and get into the literalism or the interpretation of their Constitution. But can we just go back a step to what was it that the people who wrote the Constitution actually wanted to enshrine? What was the spirit of why people should be allowed to carry weapons? What was it that they were afraid of? What was it they wanted to empower society with? Now, I'm not going to get into that any further, but it's a good example of where there's a lot of debate around the religion, the law, but there isn't much debate as to, is the spirit of that law still relevant or not? And so many religions have become like that, where you have to do, you have to do, you have to do. But why? And what is the religion's belief? What is the religion's view of the world? What is the purpose of reality? And often these questions get trivialized and boiled down into do good, don't do bad, and things like that, and just get on with it. Mm-hmm. So with the rise of spirituality in the last 70 years, so you go back to the 60s, there's this incredible spiritual revolution that has winds from the East. So the Eastern traditions and of Hinduism and Brahmanism and Buddhism and other isms that come along, people start discovering meaning and purpose. And as that keeps filtering through the 60s and the 70s and a bit of the 80s and 90s, well, let's just do 60s and 70s, there is this purpose, there is a meaning, there is a tranquility that there are systems out there that are offering that don't at all sound or resonate like the conventional religions, be they the Judeo-Christian or contemporary philosophies of the day. Then you go through the 80s and 90s, and there are a whole lot of scientists who are putting these spiritual systems through the ringer and going, oh my gosh, this is so healthy, like meditation and etc. And so we get this westernized version of Eastern tradition. And as that becomes something that it's healthy, it's good, it's stress relieving, you will feel better, well, that is always going to appeal to our more animalistic side, where I want to feel better. So if you're telling me spirituality will make me feel better, well, 1 + 1 is going to equal 2. And so you have both a sincere drive towards spirituality as well as I wouldn't say an insincere, but I'd say a more self-oriented drive towards spirituality where it's better for me. Either way, that's good. And so we fast forward another 20 years into the 2000s and 2010s and now into the 2020s. And we've got this rise of meaning and feeling good. Now, spirituality, though, goes well beyond the spiritual systems of the East. When we talk about spirituality today, I presume we mean everything from environment to doing good by and representing underprivileged and wanting to correct the injustices in the world, all the way through to Eastern tradition. And so it's a big lump sum tangible altruism where people would say, oh, if I do this, I can see it's doing good. I feel good about that. Whereas the old religions or the religions as they've become have become very much about, but you've got to show up, you've got to do, you've got to show up, you've got to do. But there isn't a lot of why. So you're telling me I've got to do. I don't see the impact. How does I don't know, shaking a palm branch if you're a Jew, what good is that doing for the world? Or how is not eating meat for a month in the year, what good is that doing for the world? And so the religious systems, which actually have very complex, beautiful, sophisticated spiritual systems, are being lost to a very easily accessible sense of meaning and purpose. And a sense of meaning and purpose that is proven to be healthy. So we don't have as many studies saying being a Catholic or being a Jew or being a Protestant is actually good for you, even though I'm sure there are plenty of studies that could prove that. So I think we've got this rise of spirituality because it has had this natural charm and an ability to connect with. And with that, the natural openness people have has led people to explore.
I intuitively agree with that. And I think I'm almost frustrated by my, because I went to a Catholic school thank you for that, because I've never really heard someone say it. And it was exactly my experience. It was do this. And no one could tell me why, because they themselves had been told to just do it. And no one really, you know, and I listen to a lot of religious based podcasts that give me those answers, you know. And one of the greatest ones was just going back and learning about some of the psychological significance of the Old Testament as an example, and understanding what the hell the Garden of Eden is all about and the fall into painful consciousness. And I can, you know, remember so many moments in my life where I've learnt about an objective truth that is difficult to acquiesce to, that then as a result has made me more of an individual, more of a man, more responsible. And that metaphor was one of the first books in a book that I spend a lot of my earlier years afraid of, and I am so happy to be alive right now because I have access to these books and these podcasts. And I also now wonder if that I had a mentor or an influencer or a teacher who was talking to me about the morality in these parables and Cain and Abel, and you know, resentment being going down one way and you know, what Abel was doing being something else, it would have really helped. So it's interesting.
Yeah. So you've said a few things that have like just gone, it's fire. I've got neurons firing all over the joint now. without wanting to sound judgmental or pompously academic, which I can do very easily, I lapse into snobbish conduct. No, but I don't have evidence for what I'm saying. I can only say this anecdotally. People have a fear of being wrong. And the phrase "don't throw good money after bad" is a phrase because obviously most people do throw good money after bad. And as we spend more time defending and believing in something, the more we want it to be right. And so I think we have been educated by a generation of people who may not have been given the opportunity to have a choice or to explore, and we're told that they have to accept something. So by the time they're of a maturer age, they have to defend their beliefs. And if you ask a question, you may be threatening their beliefs or causing them to feel like you're going to depart. And that would be a failing on them if their descendants, if their children, if their students reject their beliefs. Or they don't have the answers and they're embarrassed. Or so there's a whole host. And therefore, the need to transmit the message has become very paramount in many, many different faith-based traditions. But and with that, at the same time, to defend it and protect the religion from anything is shut down the questioning. It's not an intentional shutdown, but it's a natural reaction. When you don't, when a teacher is asked a question, they don't know the answer. You can either say, I don't know, but vulnerable is a popular thing today. You know, Brené Brown didn't live in the 1960s. So we didn't do vulnerable then. We didn't do vulnerable in the 1980s, 90s. You know, authority knows all. And in the 80s, there's a rise in authority. I mean, there's some fascinating studies about policing and government involvement in the 80s and how people want that. You know, that whole, when we were kids, we used to play in the street until the sun came down. Our parents didn't know where we were. Yeah, that was in the 50s and 60s. In the 80s, you didn't go to the park without telling your mum exactly where you were and what time you'd be back. And if you weren't back in the 90s, you were going to be absolutely punished.
Yes.
So there is that whole authoritarian transmission. So so that's speaking to one thing about what you said, which is how the education that we got in a religious context doesn't seem to have that engagement or that vulnerability. And there's also this need to protect the religion as if the religion needs us to protect it, as opposed to the religion being a guide or the spirit or the religion being a spiritual guide for us that can inform. So there's this idea of a mentor, and there's an old Jewish teaching, Aseh Lecha Rav, make for yourself a mentor, a master. This is not a master from an authority, but actually a spiritual, social mentor, someone you can bounce off. And to be a mentor requires that you can empathize with the person you're mentoring and be very human. So if you don't know the answer, you're allowed to say, I don't know the answer, because that gives the person permission to grow, because you're not this idyllic, impossible character, this oracle, but actually you're a senior person to that person. You may be younger, but you've got seniority in life experience. And so to mentor and to deliver the message and then say, well, this is what I believe, and these are the teachings of Cain and Abel or the Exodus or whatever, and you can draw a philosophy from it. I'm sure we'll come back to this. For me, it goes beyond that. It's the spiritual messaging that comes through. But then the practices become so much more, and they become wisdom that can inform our choices rather than dogmas that we must align with for social belonging.
You know, you have really examined this, I feel, at least from my perspective, over the many years, even decades, that I've kind of had a perspective on, you know, spirit grow and how it's evolved. It seems like a number of years ago, you've developed this this system, which really was quite unique for you know, like a Jewish religious vehicle for you to be able to express. How was it expressing the way you thought about religion when you decided to kind of flesh out Spirit Grow to the wider community when you first started that process?
I'm smiling because it's a very uninspiring and inauthentic beginning. So
I'm picturing there Tiananmen
was no
Square
moment on the mountain. It was quite. I know. I look at the people in Tiananmen Square and I just say, "Run! There's a tank coming. What are you doing?" That's me. I admire the people that have the guts to do that. I don't believe I have that. So I grew up in an observant Jewish home. I went to an observant Jewish school. I had observant Jewish friends, and I didn't have too many issues with it. I would call that socially orthodox or socially observant. So I maintained the social status quo of my peers, my circle, because why not? We're all happy. We'd go to synagogue on a Saturday, and we'd catch up and we'd schmooze, and you can look the part, but you just catch up. And if you know, you're doing it, you go to school and you learn stuff. And I wasn't a strong student in school in any subject. So Jewish studies, maths, sciences, it's all the same to me. It's just like in one ear, out the other, fail the test, move to the next year level. So I just went along with it. And in short, my desire in life, if you would have asked me at age 19, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would have told you very sincerely, I want to be rich. That's what I want to be when I grow up. I wanted to be involved with charity and community work as far as being a patron goes. That would be about as close to doing good as I would get. I would support important causes, but I wanted a very hedonistic, comfortable life. I didn't come from a poor home. My parents both worked. I had a bed. We had food. We went on a holiday during summer somewhere in Victoria. All very good. So it's not like I aspire, but like I just hedonistic, selfish. And fast forward a few years when Spirit Grow started, I wasn't that. It's something more that my father gave birth to, and he asked me whether I wanted to be involved, and I said yes, because I did believe in it. I believed in the importance of it, and I wasn't doing anything else. I just become a rabbi. I'd just been ordained, and even I didn't get ordained because I was going to go that path. It was just something to do. I know it sounds weird, but it's like doing an MBA or whatever, or doing law. I might use it as a stepping stone to something else. So I didn't have any great aspirations or anything. And then when Spirit Grow started and I was involved and I'm teaching, I had the knowledge. And to be very honest, I was a cocky bastard. I knew that I knew more than most of the people in the room on the subject matter I was speaking on. So I wouldn't prepare classes any more than just give myself a quick structure of what I want to go through. But I wasn't respecting the participants in a way that I would actually want a teacher to respect the participants. I was like, give me a topic and I'll teach it, no worries. And I did that. But it was as people would ask questions, and as I was having more authority in teaching and more programs that I was responsible for, I had to start opening books again and learning. And a few things led to another where I believed in what I was talking about, but again, I don't think it was deep down me. It was just something I was good at. Mm. So fast forward a couple of years into Spirit Grow is when things started clicking within me. I grew up with meditation. So when I was eight, we were driving to Byron Bay. My father was delivering meditation workshops, and we'd sit in the back of the room. Like, we grew up with it. We were around it. It was there. We would imitate it. Like, close your eyes. Like, when I was 10, we'd joke. Like, we'd have guests at the Shabbos table, guests at the Friday night dinner table. And at some point I knew I could find my moment to make the adults laugh. And I just say to everyone, okay, close your eyes. And I could do a full meditation. Like, so it all was quite easy, more so than natural. But it was as things started, I suppose everyone matures, especially in their 20s, we start maturing. And there were a few things that led to a realization that spirituality is not an academic subject, which it had been until then for me. I've got plenty of books on spirituality. I'd read them, I'd studied them, but actually turning it into a personal spirituality, a framework for living. It's like, I'm short-sighted. I put on a pair of glasses one day and things look different. And I didn't want to take them off, even though I was getting a headache. Like, I had to get used to it, but I didn't want to take them off. And then came the desire to want to share that perspective with others who were seeking that. So not so much as everyone's got to know this, but more that if there are many pathways, many ways to wear glasses, many different glasses to wear, this might actually fit really well for some people. And I started actually experimenting with Judaism, meaning I no longer was doing it. I was no longer spiritually exploring for the sake of it or because of my role. I was experimenting with what this felt like. And it went in interesting places. Like, it was pretty trippy at different points, without any drugs, alcohol, just different meditations and different subject matter. At one point, my wife was a bit concerned. Like, she was more than a bit concerned. Like, what's going on here? Like, and she wasn't sure, is this just like one of my things? Like, oh yeah, I get into different things, or am I taking a hard turn here and evolving? So it was really, really interesting. And then coming back and settling, that has informed a lot of what Spirit Grow is. And so Spirit Grow is very different in that you have many spiritual centers that may be run by Jewish people, but I take I'm seriously respectful and I implement the lifestyle of Judaism, but in a very, very strict way, because I see that as the lifestyle that it is the way to implement the spirituality. I want to live with it, so I need tasks, I need activities, and that is what life is. Life is a series of postures. It's a bit like yoga. Yoga is more than exercise. Yoga is more than building core strength. It is a posture. Now, it could be for some people, it is exercise. It is breathing. It is stress relief. It is building flexibility and inner strength. But actually, yoga is so much more. That's like incidental. It's a deep mystical spiritual system. And so I adhere to the Jewish tradition in a very orthodox way, if you will, because I want the spirituality to permeate every aspect, from every chewing of food through to the way I rise from my bed in the morning, to the way I conduct myself with my children. And that sounds all very ideal. I should say I try, but I want that in every aspect of my life. And so the Jewish religion is offering a posture for the Jewish spirituality. And I think all religions should do that and are that. And maybe in the 21st century, we're ready to teach people about a spirituality that they go, oh, that sounds cool. Oh, do you want a posture for it? Yeah, some will say yes, and some will say, no, thanks. I'll make my own up using the philosophy and spirituality you've given me. Thank you very much. And we've got to be open to both.
Mm. How does Judaism help you with your there's that expression where it's like the concept or idea of God keeps us hidden away from the direct experience of God, where it's like you can touch a concept, but unless you have that true intuitive experience, direct experience, either through spirituality or some sort of psychedelic journey or solitude or whatever it is, you can't ever know it. But I've kind of got two questions for you, Menachem. I was wondering how Judaism helps you specifically with your spirituality, and then also how does Judaism distinguish itself from perhaps other main religions, even in the Abrahamic tradition?
I'll start with the first.
Sure.
The second one is touching on a theological, and while I may have read a few books and I love it, it's not necessarily my strength, but we'll see what we can produce on that.
I've got a lot of questions.
The first question was, remind me.
So, yeah, how does Judaism help your spirituality, your direct experience with God?
Okay. This is how it is for me. And there is no one path of Jewish spirit. Within Jewish spirituality, there are many pathways. Some may even contradict each other, but ultimately they are all correct pathways. So you can't turn right and left at the same time. But when you're driving a car, both right and left are legitimate turns. So so the pathways don't all sit nicely within each other, but they all operate within this rubric of Jewish spirituality. So I can only represent a particular few, of which there's one in particular, but I can't say I haven't dabbled in other things. Not that there's anything wrong, but it feels a bit, you know, almost I'm making it sound blasphemous to dabble in your own religion. Anyway, so we're very, very fortunate that there is this very strong value in the Jewish tradition in academia and writing things down, and that there is an academic process, because that means there's plenty of material to read, plenty of material to consume, and plenty of material to find your pathway within. So the particular schools of spirituality that I've studied and continue to study and continue to immerse in are ones that drive the student to seek out the godliness in everything, what we might call the soul, what we might call the infinite. Because it's important when we talk about God, I don't mean a humanoid character. God is does not have a beard. God is not masculine. God is not an entity that's out there. All this is within the infinite energy and consciousness that we can call God. So it's not the universe, which is a common term nowadays. People say they put it out to the universe. The universe is limiting. No matter how you want to define the universe, it's limiting. Is it a physical universe? Is it a metaphorical universe? When we talk about God, we're talking about the universe is just a speck of possible reality within an infinite consciousness that is present in the microbe as well as in the macro. And so the spirituality is to seek that out, to see it. So it's to see it in time, it's to see it in objects, it's to see it in people. It's and so empathy and love are very powerful ways to connect and feel. How do you feel someone else's emotion? They're not your emotions, but you can. There is this non-tangible way of building a bridge. And so what if we can go beyond that? And so the spiritual texts will provide meditations and ideas, really well-developed ideas that slowly help you stretch your brain to think differently. So much like if you study physics, so you do a month of physics, you do a year of physics, you do 5 years of physics, your whole world looks different. So, you know, a physicist walks into a room and goes, oh my God, there's light waves and particles, and I love how that's absorbing that and it's reflecting that and the tension of this. Like, they're just blown away by reality because it's because of what they know is happening in front of them. So if spirituality is much like that, where it's stretching your perspective with where you're going well beyond just sitting silently into actually viewing everything. And so it's not just how you view, but then your practices of life become ways to engage. So the purpose of Judaism is that a person should be able to connect or be able to find a path to connecting and seeking the spiritual energy that resides within everyone and everything. Everything else is practice of how to do that. So our dietary laws, the way we eat, it's because I can connect with certain things through this mode called eating. I cannot connect with certain things through the mode of eating, but I can wear them, or I can look at them, or I can sit in their shade or whatever, and I can appreciate them and also respect their soulful origin. And now it's not just in this two-dimensional, oh, everything has a soul, but actually starting to think about the world as a manifestation of a spiritual reality, and just thinking about the process. How does the concept of a reality become a reality and then actually become like a phone, a tree, a bookshelf? How has that become? And just to be blown away by the magic of it all, not in a supernatural magic, but you know, the excitement of it all. And so now when you start living like that, things get pretty good. Like, good and bad, pain and comfort become secondary. And now, but the goal is not to run to the mountain and become a monk and live at the top and immerse yourself and escape into that spiritual realm, but actually to come back from the mountain and see that in play in the physical, tangible, and to bring your consciousness on board, to bring your animalistic desire on board, to reform and to refine, I should say, to refine self, to refine the world around us. That is much more profound, and that's the goal. It's not enough to have discovered it. We've got to bring it all the way into the physical, tangible here and now. And that's what life is for me. So in the workplace, family, this, everything. And sure, sometimes I'm an absolute glutton and I just want to eat because I'm hungry and I love the taste of it. And sometimes I can practice a bit of restraint and then get in the restraint to, hey, hold up that gluttonous thing and just get into the headspace of, this is bread. This is wheat. This is water. This is an incredible product that someone has labored. There is a soul that has been reincarnated into the kernel that I'm about to eat. And am I going to consume that and I'm just going to crap it out, or am I going to consume it and its soul and my soul are going to become one? And the water and the meat, it was a living animal. And then it died. Did it die because of unethical behavior and because I'm hungry, or did it die because it lived And now I can take it to a step further. What does a step further mean? I can help an old person cross the road because I have the energy to carry their bags because I ate a meal for breakfast, which was an egg or it was a sausage or it was a salad or whatever. And now that cow, that carrot, that granule of grain, that molecule of water is not just a molecule of water. It is helping an old lady cross the road.
Mm-hmm.
And to hold that in your mind all the time, it can make you go nuts, but hold it in your mind a bit of the time and it can make us really altruistic.
Mm. I love that.
Did you have a part B there, Tom?
That I did. I think I just got lost in the moment. I was really excited.
No, it was an amazing something to really, really tangible to chew on as well.
Yeah.
If I could just tie it back, because I presume, Tom, you're also in the health world, like Paul is.
Yeah, so I work as a counselor.
Okay, so let's just take both of you as examples. So where exercise? What is exercise? Exercise, health, fitness, well-being is about looking after the body that is the expression of my soul.
Mm.
If I'm a zlob that can't get off the couch and I do nothing to change my well-being, then I'm actually preventing my soul from fully expressing itself in this world.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So I need to look after my health, because not because I want to live a long life, but because I want to give my soul the greatest ability to express itself in this world.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about exercise, it's not like you've got religion and then you've got exercise and then you've got your psychology. No, it's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing. You exercise to look after the body that is a gift. You go to your counselor because very real, whether it be trauma, whether it be just stuff in our own mind, whether it be relationships, all of these things, if you think about it, are either hampering or able to enable our soul's expression in this world.
Mm.
So what is marriage? Marriage is two souls being fused together. Now, if their physical lifestyle is causing that to come apart, well, then we've got a serious issue here. And prayer is not the solution to that. Because it may be that ego is driving this, and or it is a bad habit, or it is a bad memory or a trauma that's happened. Just tackle that. Pray that that works. Mm. But it's a vehicle. Both of you are actually conduits, and both of you are coaches. Both of you are spiritual mentors that mentor people in a particular path of spirituality, the spirituality of the body, the spirituality of the mind and emotion. Just as what am I? I'm a spiritual mentor. I give content. What is a chef? What is anyone? We're all actually very spiritual characters in this very perfect world.
Love that. Mm.
Yeah, that's spot on, isn't it? Yeah.
So the other question you had was how we differ from other religions. I would say just get a whole lot of different religious people on.
Yes.
And start seeing what we say differently to one another.
which is really interesting that you bring that up, Menachem, because that's definitely on our to-do list.
Oh, good.
Yes. We actually have a plan as well that we might do an in-person show, and we might get, you know, a rabbi to speak with a monk, to speak with a Christian brother, you know, and get us all having a conversation, because it's just so... You know, it's a shame we kind of have to cut this short, because we'd love to have you back on, but it's just these questions are, you know, obviously the way I see the world is very much filtered through my own biases and childhood and projections and so forth. But I could listen to you talk for hours, because as a man who's dedicated his life to understanding these traditions and the spiritual significance of these traditions and religions, I can't help but feel like it's really missing, you know. And I kind of have some anecdotal evidence to prove this as well, with a lot of the purpose and meaning and the existential confusion that comes up with a lot of the young adults that I speak to, you know, in a world that is just so abundant with opportunity. And, you know, Paulie and I speak about this all the time in the podcast. It's therefore very difficult to make value judgments and figure out what to do, because you can do anything, and therefore there's no meaning in anything, you know. And coming back to, I mean, you know, the value that I've taken from understanding some of the significance of the Old Testament and then the life of Jesus, but also, you know, Buddha's life and how it wasn't enough for him to become enlightened. He actually had to bring, like what you were saying before, he had to come back down off the mountain, and that's when the hero's journey ends. It's only after you spread the message that's when the journey ends and therefore begins for someone else. And all of this knowledge that has shaped my life in so many wonderful ways that I can't help but feel like it's really, really missing in our society.
Yes, it is something that is missing. And I think that's that many people are either acutely aware or subconsciously aware, which is why they strive and gravitate towards all sorts of causes, as I said earlier on. The religions have a bit of a bad rap, somewhat justifiably, sometimes not. I just lumped all religion in one basket. But hopefully, as people tune in and they listen, they'll say, oh, that person really resonates with me. I want to go and see what he or she is on about. There's this idea in Hebrew. It's a combo of Hebrew and Yiddish that we're in the Golus of Freiheit, that which literally means we're in the exile of freedom, meaning the challenge that we have today is unprecedented. As a Jewish person, it's unprecedented to live in a time where we're not persecuted en masse, where most countries have not only no problem with Jews, but protect religious freedom and minorities to, and almost want to protect their traditions and value that. This is unprecedented in Jewish history. But in a way, it's also quite unprecedented for humans that so much of the world has so much opportunity, you know, so much democracy, so much say in who's going to govern, so much opportunity to try to work, to try to make a living, to try to do something with some money. I'm not necessarily saying to become rich, but there is a lot more opportunity today than ever before in human history en masse. And I think as a society, we're struggling with that. Mm-hmm. You know, so Jewish people were persecuted for most of Jewish history. It's quite easy to be a Jew in a times of persecution because you're very limited for choice. It's survival, and religion thrives in a survival setting. So you just get on with it. You find your meaning and your camaraderie and your brotherhood and your sisterhood and your community, and you get chucked out and you rebuild a new life in a new country. And there are a few people who got there first, and you speak Yiddish or Hebrew or whatever. It just goes. But to be free and to then have the luxury of everything, it's how do I find the balance? I could seek spirituality, or I could seek money, or I could seek love and pleasure. So many things that we're actually spoilt for choice. All people are spoilt for choice. Sometimes we realize how lucky we are, sometimes we don't realize how lucky we are. But the challenge that the Western world is facing today is to manage the luxury of freedom and the luxury of opportunity. And it's a collective challenge. It's not just the rich people, it's not just the people in power, it's all of us. It's down to the granular individual, household and community, and then society. And we're struggling our way through it. And I think that there is merit in, as you said, there are merits in the ancient teachings of the ancient people. The lessons that seem to have withstood the test of time may very well not only withstand this era of time, but maybe they withstood because there is wisdom and there is depth. And we can look past our cynicism. Oh, is there a God? Isn't there a God? Let's go beyond that. Let's look at what is the wisdom teaching here, just as the scientists did in the 80s and the 90s. The 70s, the 80s, in order to develop like mindful-based stress management and things like that, they could have just said, ah, weird Asians, Indians. No, they didn't. They said, I may or may not think Buddha is a literal person, but there is wisdom here. And the wisdom is, I believe, is the opportunity to take freedom and turn freedom into not just a challenge, but the most incredible opportunity ever. We are potentially on the cusp of a true evolution of the world. And I think that spirituality plays a role within the freedom.
It's
it's amazing because it's such a paradox that you just described there, this new age that we live in where we're so comfortable but we're almost imprisoned by that, you know?
Yeah.
It's a great place to kind of just sit and perhaps we'll wind up the chat there, and possibly if you're open to it, have you on another time, because there's so much to uncover and flesh out. But the tenets that you've talked about, that really you've kind of embraced within the way you see Judaism and the way people kind of are embracing in today's day and age. And we have a different series and set of challenges that come up where in this new world that we almost feel limitless but are imprisoned by, you know?
Yeah.
I just want to thank you for coming on the show. It's been incredible for you to have a chat about where you've come from, but also how you see Judaism kind of honoring, you know, your life and the way we can use religion and spirituality to kind of grow.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Don't let the show become too religious. It'll be your undoing. Keep it broad.
Do you have any recommendations?
Life is more than just religious dialogue.
That's true.
No, it's been awesome. Menachem, you're an absolute gentleman, a mensch.
Thank you. I
thank you very, very much.
I'll see you both soon again in person.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Love that. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Good luck.
Guys, we'll talk to you very soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.